Let us look together now at Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah chapter 2. We're going to begin at verse 1, and we're going to stop at the end of verse 4. As difficult as it is to stop right in the middle of a drama like this, but that's as far as we're going to get today. And it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been beforetime sad in his presence. Wherefore the king said unto me, Why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then I was very sore afraid, and said unto the king, Let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad, when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? Then the king said unto me, For what dost thou make request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. May God bless the reading of his holy word. We have seen thus far in Nehemiah this great interest in the cause of God in Jerusalem, the broken heart of Nehemiah at the report of the condition of the city, about the only thing encouraging was the fact that the temple had been rebuilt, but that was many years before, and nothing else had been accomplished since then, nothing as far as strengthening the city, rebuilding the walls, resetting the gates, and so on. And so that led to this intense season of prayer that we saw last time. This prayer that in many ways is a model to us in many things concerning prayer. Confession of sin. Great reverence for God, of course, at the beginning. And a plea for his covenant mercy. And it closed with a prayer for favor with the Persian king, Artaxerxes. Verse 11 of chapter 1 says, Grant him, that is me, your servant, mercy in the sight of this man. And this man, of course, was the greatest earthly power at that time, King Artaxerxes of Persia. Nehemiah seems to, at this point, have this desire to be involved some way in helping the cause of God in Jerusalem. And I think it's awfully easy to assume too much in some cases as we read a narrative like this. I'm not really clear in my own mind that Nehemiah thought that he would be the one to actually go and be the one on the ground to help lead in the work. His home is in the palace. His duties are there. He's a slave to the king. That's where he's going to be for the rest of his life, as far as he knows. But because of his proximity to the king as the cupbearer, which only divine providence could have arranged, there might be an opportunity for him to influence the king to change his previous decree that we saw there in Ezra chapter 4. And, you know, the Medes and Persians are famous to this day for not changing their laws, not changing their decrees. You know, the laws of the Medes and Persians stands no matter what. But it is interesting then that Artaxerxes himself had left a little loophole when he ordered the work stoppage that had been begun by some there in Jerusalem to rebuild the walls and the gates of the city. But then, of course, the enemies, the Gentiles surrounding them in that region sent a warning to Artaxerxes by mail, and they said, do you know what these Jews are doing? If they rebuild this city, they're going to set up an army and they're going to rebel against you. That's the history of these people. They're a hot-headed bunch of war mongers, and you should order them to stop any further repairs. And so that's what Artaxerxes did. And it's recorded in Ezra chapter 4, which is, in that section of Ezra, a flash forward before we come back to the time frame of Zerubbabel there in the first half of Ezra. But listen to what Artaxerxes said. Give ye now commandment to cause these men to cease, and that this city be not builded until, now, and he doesn't put a period there, there's a comma, until another commandment shall be given from me. And you have to know that every person who had any heart for Jerusalem, whether they actually lived there or whether it was someone like Nehemiah back in Shushan, the palace in Persia, that loophole was well rehearsed in their minds. Until another commandment shall be given from me. So Artaxerxes didn't lock himself in. He leaves an opening that the policy might be revised in the future by him. No doubt Nehemiah is aware of this. And it's important for us to understand as best we can the mindset of this king. He was happy enough for the temple to be rebuilt. And in these various nations that were allowed to repatriate, they could build their temples to their gods. And in his mind, the Jews building the temple to Jehovah was just one among many. But to have the city built, to have walls built around, for it to be a defended and a defensible position against his armies, that's a whole other matter. As we look at Nehemiah's prayer, we don't see any request specifically that he would be sent to Jerusalem. And that is part of what makes me question whether that thought had even entered his mind. Maybe it was sort of a pipe dream. Oh, how I would love to go and be there and help rebuild the city, but that's never going to happen. But what could happen is I might be able to get the king to revisit that work stoppage and allow work to resume. That could be the critical part that Nehemiah could play. That might be the most important contribution of his life to the cause of God in the earth. As a slave to the king in the palace, it was beyond his right to ask for any favors. In fact, he was probably not even allowed to initiate any conversation with the king. He is truly a dumb waiter. He says nothing. He comes and does his job and leaves, and he's not heard from and only seen in as much as necessity requires. In the event, it seems that God granted to Nehemiah more than he had asked or thought. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, and most of that needs to wait for next week. As we look at these verses now in chapter 2, we're just going to look at the actions here and follow the drama and make some applications. I don't really have a very neat outline of things. But at the end of chapter 1, he says, I was the king's cupbearer. That's that little piece of information that is so important as the story develops. And I just want to say this in way of application here. Nehemiah was a servant of the king. He was a steward to the king, a butler to the king. But he was also a steward to God. He had a stewardship given to him from God. He was a servant or slave to Jehovah. And it was Nehemiah's privilege and duty to bring those two relationships together. I should say to bring the one under the other. To bring the stewardship to Artaxerxes under the stewardship to God. We should all use our influence wherever we are. Wherever God has providentially placed us, we have a stewardship to Him as well as to whoever we answer to. Our Lord taught us to be faithful in a few things. And so Nehemiah was. And then the Lord gave him more things and more ways in which to serve. Remember in various of the New Testament epistles, at least three that come to mind, we read of duties for servants and for masters. And as far as the servants or slaves are concerned, we're told to consider ourselves as slaves to God. See that He is our ultimate master. And He has put whatever level of earthly authority between us and God that is on this earth. And of course, the duties for masters includes that they also have a master in heaven, and that they should be good masters to their servants on earth. But Nehemiah, as most of us are, is in the position of the slave and the servant. Well, we come to verse 1. It came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king. This, again, is an important time stamp because it is 4 months since the month Kislew mentioned in verse 1. These are the Jewish names of the months, but and actually Nisan is the first month of a new year on the Jewish calendar, but not so on the Persian calendar. It's all the same year. Their year begins at a different point. But it means, again, as we mentioned last time, that Nehemiah has been praying for 4 months. The prayer of verse 1 is no doubt a summary of what he was praying night and day, at least twice a day, and probably throughout the day, for 4 months. Let me just take this opportunity once again to emphasize the importance of persevering in prayer. We may give up on man, we may give up on ourselves, we may give up on circumstances, but let us never give up on God. Let us persevere in prayer. Nehemiah did not want to act too quickly and, as we would say, get ahead of God, but nor does he want to drag his feet and move too slowly. There is a delicate balance here in waiting on God and praying to God. And I have no doubt that Nehemiah here is an example to us in one who was able to strike that perfect balance. He's not hesitating, nor is he hasty. Either one of those would make his prayer to be empty words. You can get in a hurry and get ahead of God, and your prayer isn't really waiting on God at all. Or you can drag your feet when it's time for action, and then your prayer again is just some empty words. I think I would describe these 4 months in Nehemiah's life as months of eager patience. Eager patience. Waiting on God is not wasting. Until God makes the path clear, prayer is the right action. Then when providence makes the path clear, it's time to act. And that's what we see here unfolding in chapter 2. If you put yourself in Nehemiah's shoes in that time, you understand the precarious position he was in. He's not allowed to speak, and so he's dependent upon the king to initiate conversation. When an opportunity does arise to address whatever the king has said to him, it's going to be dangerous to bring up Jerusalem. That's a sore point. The king will not have forgotten that he ordered the work stoppage based upon this report of potential for rebellion over there in Jerusalem. Even bringing up the subject is going to be difficult and even could be dangerous. It would amount to Nehemiah saying, King Jerusalem is in a shambles and it's your fault. On the other hand, the king might be suspicious of Nehemiah's concern and interest about Jerusalem and even bringing up the matter, and could easily accuse him of having some kind of conspiracy at heart, or maybe part of a bigger conspiracy that the king has not uncovered. Nehemiah's life could hang by a thread in an instant. Now you see why he's praying for just the right providential time and circumstances to put some kind of, as we say, bug in the king's ear concerning the need in Jerusalem. By the wording of verse 1 here, it's not real clear how regular Nehemiah's access to the king was. The wording leaves some question about it. It says wine was before him. Maybe there were times where Nehemiah's cup bearing was not called for, not needed, and some think that maybe the king didn't need him for the 4 months. But we don't know that. Anyway, the time came. And he says, I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. And some of the historians describe this process. It's, at least in some places, I don't know if this is how King Artaxerxes did it exactly, but there's quite a ordeal going on here where the container of the wine is brought in and the cup bearer, like Nehemiah, takes a little bit out and he drinks it and everybody watches and waits to see what happens, see if he falls over dead, to see if somebody has put some poison in the pot. That leads us to think that Artaxerxes, as no doubt an intelligent man to rise to where he was, is very observant of everyone in his court. He's observing Nehemiah, watching him carefully, under a magnifying glass, we might say, because after all, if Nehemiah turns against the king, he himself could slip in the poison. And so you've not only got to have the cupbearer for those at the outer circle that you may not trust, but you've got to make sure you can trust him also. Suppose that Nehemiah is doing his duty there, and he takes a drink of the wine and makes this ugly face. What's that going to tell the king? Something's wrong here. He's no doubt watching every reaction to the tiniest detail. He's looking at the furrows in his brow and so on as Nehemiah does his duties at the table. If the cupbearer acts in any unusual way, it could be an alarm that something's not right. Some mischief is afoot in the realm. Added to that is this well-known custom that to be anything less than happy in the presence of the king is an insult to the king. Someone who is sad is sending a message that the king isn't ruling very well in his realm. Sounds like some of these characters in North Korea today. You know, if you don't just kiss their toes, as it were, and show all, you know, that all is well and that you're happy, then he won't be happy with you. We even have a hint of this. Let's see, it's in the book of Esther, where we read that Mordecai, on this occasion, put on sackcloth with ashes, and it came even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. You can't be mourning and sad anywhere near the king. Now, let me just make a good application for us here at this point. We serve a good king. We serve the best of kings. We serve an infinitely glorious and good king. And we ought to be happy in his presence. Though men like Nehemiah perhaps to some degree had to feign happiness, our happiness before our king should be sincere and wholehearted. And we should serve the Lord with gladness and come before his presence with singing, as the psalmist says. And even in the New Testament, the apostle Paul, we're familiar with all that he suffered, all the difficulties, all the setbacks and heartaches. Yet he says, we're always rejoicing. Sorrowful, and yet always rejoicing. And he can tell the Philippians, rejoice in the Lord, and rejoice, and again I say rejoice. Our king deserves our hearty worship. And the very nature of worship is joyous. Well, The king noticed something here about Nehemiah. Something's not right. Something's not normal. If Nehemiah had been afflicting his soul with fasting and prayer for 4 months, it's bound to tell on his countenance. He's going to look thin and gaunt, and the king's going to notice. Now, there's a difference among writers and commentators on this point. Some think that Nehemiah was orchestrating this whole thing, that he was waiting just for the right moment and the right feast, and instead of being his normal, happy, jovial self, he's going to come in with this long face, and that's going to make the king ask, that's going to open up the conversation, what's your problem, what's wrong, and then there will be his time to spring into action and make his request in behalf of Jerusalem. And that everything went just according to Nehemiah's plan. Well, I don't doubt that there was a plan made by God in heaven, but I have a hard time thinking that Nehemiah could orchestrate all of this and manipulate the king like that. I tend to think that Nehemiah was trying his best on this day and every day to be pleasant and happy in the presence of the king, to look and act in a normal way, for nothing to be unusual or outstanding. I prefer to think that he's still waiting on God on this particular day to answer his prayers and to show the way, and that all that happened here in this scene was spontaneous. And it seems to me that the sudden fear that's mentioned at the end of verse 2 and the sudden urgent prayer mentioned at the end of verse 4 was not anything that Nehemiah had orchestrated. This was all the unfolding of providence in an unexpected way, and yet in an answer to his prayers. So he says, in verse 1, I had not been before time sad in his presence. Wherefore, verse 2, the king said unto me. The king, you notice, initiated the conversation. And verse 6 tells us in the parenthesis that the queen also was sitting by him. The significance of that is subject to debate. To say the least, it shows that there was a witness to the communication that occurred here. Perhaps others at the table, but at least the queen was among them. He said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Here's a question from the king, and he doesn't even pause to let Nehemiah answer. He answers it himself, you notice. Why do you have a long face, Nehemiah? You're not sick, so therefore you must be sad. And he ends with a statement. But the statement is an open door and an invitation for Nehemiah to respond. The way that I imagine things unfolding here is while Nehemiah is tasting the wine and bringing it to the king and everything, he's has a pleasant smile on his face. And the king's watching his every move, and as Nehemiah turns away, his frown comes to his face, and the king picks up on it. And the king has to ask. His own safety is involved here. He is suspicious of any ill designs. He's watching everyone in his court carefully. When he says, "Thou art not sick," was he aware of Nehemiah's health history? Maybe. Maybe if the servant was sick, he could, call in sick that day and get the assistant cupbearer to come and do the duties. Or it may be that Nehemiah, the king sees that Nehemiah has tasted the wine. He hasn't gotten sick. He hasn't thrown up. He hasn't fallen down dead. But he doesn't have the happy face. And so you're not sick. You're not sick from the wine or anything else for that matter. So you must be sad, Nehemiah. And this led to an intense fear. As verse 2 says, "Then I was very sore afraid." This is extremity of fear. His heart is beating hard. His knees are about to give out from under him. Is this Nehemiah? In all the rest of the book, we see this man who is bold and courageous, and he's willing to face down any enemies and even pick some of them up and throw them out of the temple. But here he is, very sore, very much afraid. We should not take this as a sign of any unbelief. There are times when simply circumstances are overwhelming to us, and they catch us by surprise, and there is an involuntary response like this. Nehemiah lived in this world. He knows that his life hangs at the whim of the king. As the proverb says, the wrath of a king is as messengers of death. But a wise man will pacify it. Even in the New Testament, we see Paul, that fearless, bold, brave apostle who will take on the brilliant philosophers of Athens single-handedly. Could say at one point we despaired even of life, and within were fears. We should not necessarily feel guilty when a sudden sense of fear comes upon us because of some danger around us. But what we should do is stay faithful in the path of duty and look to the Lord in those times. And of course, that's what Nehemiah did. But I hasten on. Verse 3. And said unto the king, let the king live forever. This was a common homage that servants would say to the king. It was a way of saying, your life is better than mine. My life is at your disposal, but let your life live forever. Now, of course, Nehemiah knew that Artaxerxes wasn't going to live forever on this earth. And just one little minor application, perhaps, that we should learn here is that there is a place for formalities and court pleasantries when we are put in that position by God's providence. Let the king live forever. And then he gets to the point. He unloads his soul to Artaxerxes. After all, there's nothing to lose at this point. The king has discovered something. He knows something is up. It can no longer be hidden in spite of Nehemiah's best effort. If Nehemiah had said, "Oh, nothing's wrong," that would have been worse, the worst thing that he could have said. He's honest with the king and he says, "Yes, I'm sad. And rightly so. I'm sad for a good reason." And he gives it. "The city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire." You notice he doesn't actually mention Jerusalem by name. I think there's some very careful parsing and diplomacy going on here. The king knows what city Nehemiah is talking about. And Nehemiah mentions, of all things, the graves, the sepulchres of his fathers. Well, this might be a way to get at the king's heart. Historians say that the Persians, and they are certainly not alone in this, but the Persians revered their ancestors and their graves. Perhaps Nehemiah sees a way to open a door here by mentioning this. "Place of my father's sepulchres lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire." And of course, what is implied here is that this attempt to rebuild that had been done in the days of Zerubbabel had, it was in the days closer to Nehemiah. The temple had been rebuilt in the days of Zerubbabel, but it was under the reign of Artaxerxes. And at this point, it's 60 or 70 years later that under this king, there had been at least some start made on the city walls, and then he ordered it to stop. And so this is a delicate situation. It's a delicate conversation. And Nehemiah is using great diplomacy in what he says and how he says it. There's certainly a lesson for us to learn in that. We need wisdom and discretion on what to say and on how to say it. Nehemiah's great burden for Jerusalem has led him to say what he said and to be unashamed of the fact that the king knows his grief over these matters. We should not necessarily be ashamed if others sense our grief over the low spiritual ebb in our generation and the needs of ourselves and even our own church in these days. Well, quickly here. As a fly on the wall there in the palace, I imagine a pause on the part of the king as he prepares to speak. And Nehemiah at this point is simply waiting in suspense for what is going to come out of the king's mouth. You can't even read the story. No matter how many times you've read it, every time you read it, you hold your breath. And the king said unto me, "For what dost thou make request?" Here's a favorable response from the king, at least favorable thus far. he is inviting Nehemiah to ask him, what do you want, Nehemiah? What can I do to help you, Nehemiah? He doesn't state it, but he implies that I will not deny you what you ask. So ask. At least it is an encouragement from the king to ask for something big. Something that only the king could grant. And oh my, you could make some spiritual applications from that, but I will hasten on. It's like anything will be seriously considered, Nehemiah. Well, this is the moment Nehemiah has been praying for 4 months. And here it is, right at his feet. And what should he say? What should he ask for? This was, I think, more than Nehemiah had anticipated. It's as if the king is saying to him, Nehemiah, if I signed a blank check and gave it to you, what would you write in? He isn't telling him he'll do it, but he's getting close to that. This is one of those moments where Nehemiah's life flashed before his mind, as we say. I doubt that he had expected such a wide open door as this. And so before he can answer the king, he must speak to a higher authority. Verse 4 concludes, so I prayed to the God of heaven. This was a short moment of spiritual outburst deep within Nehemiah. Perhaps he said something like, these three little words, Lord, help me. That's all he had time to pray at this moment. He couldn't say, King, give me a few minutes. I want to go to a back room here and get on my knees before God and pray. There was no time for that. He had already been doing that for 4 months, hadn't he? This is what older writers call an ejaculatory prayer. Just a short moment of pouring out his heart before God, even as he perhaps is drawing his breath and ready to speak to the king, there is this moment to seek the Lord's help. Ever so briefly. I don't think that the king or the queen or anyone else there even knew that Nehemiah had prayed in his heart at this moment. It was unobserved. It was just an instinctive response in his prayer-saturated soul. To pray to the God of heaven. And so we'll conclude with this, which is another lesson in prayer. This is the second prayer mentioned in this book, quite different from the first prayer. It's recorded in quite a few verses here. This one, not a particular word is even given. But such prayers can and should occur often with the people of God. They should not be observable by those around us. They should not hinder our duties and our work responsibilities before our earthly kings. or employers. They are simply a reflection of our longer seasons of prayer. In other words, if this is the only praying that Nehemiah had ever done, it wouldn't have been enough. But because he has spent these months in prayer, this is all that's necessary and all that is possible at this time. The longer seasons of prayer and the ejaculatory prayers complement one another. They work together. This inward moment of prayer reveals a spirit of prayer about Nehemiah constantly. It reveals a consciousness of the presence of God with him everywhere, all the time. That's one of the presuppositions of prayer, that God is here, God is present, he hears. This kind of prayer is something that is no doubt instinctive to the child of God, and yet it can and should be developed. May God help us to develop a habit of short bursts of prayer. This is one way to pray to God without ceasing and to find grace to help in time of need, as Hebrews 4:16 tells us. Now, let me close with this emphasis. I think it is safe to say that Nehemiah would agree that prayer changes things. There are some people who get a little teaspoon of Calvinism, and oh, they become so smart. And they like to instruct everyone around them and fill them in on the deep mystery that prayer does not change God. And of course, they're right. Prayer doesn't change God, and God is immutable, and his decree is immutable and perfect. But what seems to happen is those little tyros no longer pray at all. Because prayer doesn't change God, then there's no need to pray really at all. Prayer is for those poor Arminians. From our earthly perspective, prayer changes things. I think Nehemiah would argue with anyone who says otherwise. God doesn't change, but God changes things, and God changes people, and he changes the heart of kings in his hand like a river of water. And he may be pleased to do that in answer to prayers. God accomplishes things. God changes circumstances upon this earth. And he invites us, and more than invites, he commands us to ask him to work, to change, to provide, to help. We have, for example, in Luke 11, that parable of the neighbor at midnight. And that is given to us as an example and as an encouragement to pray to God and to pray with what there is called importunity, which means shameless persistence. Do we pray that way? Do we pray to God with importunity? Or have we gotten to be such great theologians that we've painted ourselves into a corner where prayer means nothing and is unnecessary? God help us to avoid that error. Beloved, let us be praying earnestly for God's blessings and for God to change things. To change things with us and in us that need to be changed. And to change what needs to be changed in us as a people, as a body, as a church. To change what needs to be changed in our nation. And what needs to be changed in other nations. And what needs to be changed in other churches. Let us pray to the God of heaven. And pray long prayers when that's appropriate. And pray short prayers when that's appropriate. Let us be people of prayer, and let us not hesitate to persist even what would be considered to a point of shamelessness in our requests to God. I'll close with these words of Basil of Caesarea. Let us with holy impudence. I've never heard those words put together before. Holy impudence. Make God ashamed that he cannot look us in the face if he do deny our importunity. And Thomas Brooks quotes Basil in that statement. So I know that Brooks would agree with that. Derek Thomas quotes Brooks in his commentary, so I know Derek Thomas agrees with that. And we ought to give it a serious hearing ourselves. Let us with holy impudence make God ashamed that he cannot look us in the face if he do deny our importunity. He's told us to pray that way and to expect him to answer. And so let us pray for the needs that we know. Well, this is the beginning of the answer to Nehemiah's prayers. But there's more to come, and we'll see that, God willing, next time.